From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in East Oakland.
Cleveland Heights.
I live in Adams Point.
Up Beach.
Coming up, we'll hear how activists are cleaning up a historic waterway in San Francisco's Bayview Hunters Point.
They would butcher the hogs, throw them in the water. So this place smelled to high heaven for many years.
Then we'll check out an exhibition that explores the immigration conflict through abandoned objects found along the U.S.-Mexico border.
I found kind of a field in Texas of children's things. There was no adult things.
And we continue our series about the families of revolutionaries today with Audie Kochiyama Holman.
So then the door knocks and there's Malcolm X. And so my mother was just so thrilled.
The world we know through different lenses. Today on Cross Currents. A few hundred years ago, a maze of rivers and streams crisscrossed San Francisco. The biggest was Islayus Creek, which started as a trickle near Twin Peaks and then slowly widened as it made its way down to the bay. At one point, most of the city tapped Islayus Creek for drinking water, and dozens of small farms used it to irrigate their crops. Today, the creek is almost entirely underground, except for a mile-long stretch near 3rd Street and Cesar Chavez. For more than a century, the small section has been a dumping ground for industrial waste, animal carcasses, and sewage, but a handful of activists are trying to change that. KALW's Joaquin Palomino has the story.
The sun is beating down on Islayus Creek, a small marine channel in Hunters Point that opens out into the bay. Homeless camps, graffiti, and factories dominate the landscape. But there's also a small, quaint park with native cherry trees and a gravel boat launch. I'm here with Bo Barnes, a longtime resident of San Francisco, who's getting ready to take me kayaking out on the water.
Okay, why don't you grab your paddle here? Let's get in. I'm gonna hold the boat for you first, and you can do it just like I showed you. Okay, right leg in.
Bo is a laid-back guy with shoulder-length hair and an easy smile. He's also a pro on the water. He's taught kayaking most of his life and considers Islayus Creek a refuge in southeast San Francisco.
Okay, here we go.
We push into Islayus Creek and head east. Abandoned factories and crumbling piers surround us.
All right.
As we get further and further from shore, the water gets calmer, the air crisper, and the sounds of the city become a distant hum.
If you get 300 yards off the shore, it's like you're in the Sierra wilderness. There's nobody there.
And you kind of wonder, 200 years ago, this is what it was like right here, right now. Nothing's changed. They can't change it.
While the tidal pull of seawater into and out of the bay might be the same as it was a few centuries ago, pretty much everything else has changed. Islayus Creek used to be one of the largest rivers in San Francisco. From its headwaters near Twin Peaks, it coursed through Glen Canyon and down what's now Alamany Boulevard before exiting out into a huge wetland on the bay. After the gold rush, dozens of slaughterhouses set up on its shores, dumping sheep guts and pig carcasses into it. There's even a story that the water itself used to run red.
They would butcher the hogs, throw them in the water. So this place smelled to high heaven for many years.
By the mid-20th century, the slaughterhouses mostly shut down, and Islayus Creek became a magnet for metal scrappers and people down on their luck. Homeless camps cropped up, and even a few floating meth labs moved in.
And there were needles and things that were just unhealthy for the neighborhood.
At a certain point, the community got fed up. Environmentalists, boaters, and labor activists all joined together. Their goal? To build a waterfront park and clean up the area. One of the activists is Derek Green. For decades, Derek and his late father, Archie, have tried to renovate a now-defunct cargo crane on Islayus Creek, which used to move dried coconut, or copra.
The history of the copra crane goes way back. This was a booming port where ships tied up, men working out on the pier and on the ships, longshoremen were working.
The only thing left of Islayus Creek's once-bustling copra industry is the crane. It's been broken into 5 pieces, though, and gathers rust along the shore. Derek is working with other labor leaders and the city to have it reassembled and turned into a labor landmark with a museum nearby.
The people in the Bayview District and the Dog Patch area, this part of San Francisco, they're really You know, this creek belongs to them. They live here. They're entitled to a clean waterfront, a waterfront that you can walk through with a little, I call it eye candy. You'll be looking at a 50, 60-foot Copra crane that was utilized 50 years ago in San Francisco.
Since we'll be going with the ebb going back, we'll fly back.
After about an hour on the water, Bo and I paddle back into Islay's Creek from the bay. After passing under the 3rd Street Bridge, it feels like we've come back into the city.
Yeah, welcome back to Industrial America.
The shoreline is dotted with factories and freeways. The neighborhood doesn't have too much open space. So Bo's trying to make space for people out on the water.
They'll come out and they'll see the first bird flying around. And if we're lucky, we'll see cormorants swimming around, popping up with a fish in their mouth. And they really like that. We see kingfishers, we see egrets, we see blue herons, seagulls all over the place, especially if you have any food. And then my favorite flyers, the pelicans.
Bo's president of Kayaks Unlimited. The group gives free kayak lessons to novice students on the Chili Bay and occasionally takes out young people from Hunter's Point.
We want to give them an experience that they have never had, but is so easy to get. Everybody's trying to get kids to experience things early in life so that they have a full life. Well, I think they should be on the water, especially if they live blocks from it.
Other boaters are already taking advantage of the waterway.
The first time I came here, I didn't even know they existed, and I was really excited because the closest paddling center besides here is in Redwood City.
Brandon Yip comes to the small landing at Islay's Creek every week to practice dragon boating, a type of competitive racing popular here.
Knowing that this place is so close to home, I was really excited to find out that I could come here on a regular basis without too much trouble after school.
I used to actually play here when I was young. My parents would bring me down here. We would skip rocks here and also across the bridge.
Tech Lee, a longtime Bayview resident, also dragon boats on the creek.
When I was younger, no one would ever come out to see me out here. None of my friends in middle school or high school would want to even come out to Hunter's Point. But, you know, with a purpose here where we can get youth paddlers to get better and get faster, it provides a purpose to come out here, and hopefully that can get other people to start noticing that something great can happen here.
After more than a century of neglect and a few decades trying to renovate it, Islay's Creek has become more than just a forgotten backwater.
You can actually get out on the water, you can paddle out there or go see that, or are there birds out there? It's complete awakening for them, and I love it.
In the Bayview, I'm Joaquin Palomino for Cross Currents.
That story was part of our Sights and Sounds of Bayview event last year. Find out more about Kayaks Unlimited at klw.org and click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Two Oakland artists are taking an innovative look at the U.S.-Mexico border conflict in Border Cantos, an exhibition now on display at the San Jose Museum of Art. Landscape photographer Richard Mizrak and experimental composer Guillermo Galindo began collaborating on the show 4 years ago after a chance meeting at San Francisco's pop-up magazine. Reporter Julia Hutton takes a look at this nuanced exploration of border issues.
I don't photograph people literally crossing the border. That's more for journalism. I like to do kind of just a slower, meditative look at what's going on there.
There's a haunting quality to the Border Cantos images and music compositions, a multidimensional collaboration between Mizrak and composer Guillermo Galindo. They're exploring border issues by focusing on lonely objects, things they found abandoned in the border zone, a migrant's cast-off shoe, an empty food tin rolled across the sand by the wind. Simple objects take on iconic meaning in the photos and in the unconventional instruments that Galindo has built from items dropped in the sand. They're playable sculptures, some like drums or koto-shaped, made from discarded tires, cans, a metal ladder.
Everything has a very particular sound. If you really hear, you hear that everything sounds very different. There's places where you knock something that they have more resonance than others, no? It resonates in different ways.
Mizrak, who's been photographing the American desert for many years, says that for him, the border project began when he came across something startling, a mysterious group of human figures in the California desert. Something like scarecrows, they were made out of migrants' clothing, staked on tall stalks from agave plants.
I found these and I photographed them over a two-week period. I didn't see anybody around. There was no label, there was no message, there was no explanation of what they were. I didn't know if it was an art project, if it was a warning to migrants coming across the border, or they could have actually been protests to the Border Patrol. There's no explanation.
And when one finds something, it's like finding a treasure, no? It's finding a window to somebody's life.
The ghostly figures, which Mizrak calls the effigies, express tension. Their arms stretch upwards, a gesture suggesting an arrest, or physical agony, or a dance.
It almost looks like they could be something out of Michael Jackson's Thriller, or sorcerers. I mean, these effigies take on very, very different readings. That gives them their power.
For me, it's the beginning of a story, imaginary story that is going to be told by my instruments. The voice of my instruments are going to tell that story. I found bottles, and then I'm blowing into these bottles, making a tone, and this tone, it reminds me of the human breathing. And I turn it into a lament, almost like a human or an animal lament, that it's a very universal sound.
I found kind of a field in Texas of children's things. There was no adult things. I found a couple Bibles, 4 or 5 year olds, a pair of tennis shoes. I found this little girl's tweezers, you know, in the shape of a supermodel.
I found this children's backpack with a cartoon character. And my son was very young then, and he was into this cartoon character. So I opened the backpack and there was a ball. So it was very touching for me to see that.
The fate of the migrants who lost or discarded these belongings remains unclear. And the show's found objects invite many interpretations. Other stories, other layers of complication, come from a different batch of objects. They're evidence of another group that's always on the move through the borderlands, the U.S. Border Patrol.
This is the Border Patrol target range, and it's just a place where the Border Patrol does target practice.
Photographer Richard Mizrak.
There's thousands and thousands of spent cartridges on the ground, and what was amazing about them is they're very colorful. They're like confetti or candy, and I brought those back, and Guillermo thought that, ironically, they look like something you'd find in a piñata.
The piñata is a metal structure. It's in the shape of a soccer ball. We found a lot of soccer balls because in Mexico, soccer is a very important sport. And sometimes the soccer balls fly from the Mexican side of the border to the other side.
He's always playing with humor and sort of inverting what you're looking at.
So this is a structure, a metal structure that is hollow and is made in the shape of a soccer ball. And hanging from it, it has the empty shells, rifle shells from the Border Patrol.
The color of these things, which, you know, there's yellows and greens and reds and blues and grays, and they make incredible sound.
The shells that are hanging from the surface of the piñata strike the body, the metal body of the instrument. It sounds like a river full of pebbles. It's that kind of organic rhythm, no, that doesn't have a precise beat or anything. It's just organic, it just flows.
The desert working conditions were difficult, especially in more remote valleys, seas of sand and scrub surrounded by nearly barren mountains. Often photographing alone for weeks at a time, Mizrak says he rarely saw anyone, except occasionally the Border Patrol. In the backcountry, most officers advised him to leave the area, used by human traffickers, drug smugglers, and weapons runners. Carjackings are not unknown.
Am I in danger out there? I think 99.9% of the time I'm not. Has the Border Patrol told me that I am? 99.9% of the time they do.
Their relationship was complex. Once, near the border in San Diego, officers were helpful, meeting Mizrak at dawn to drive him into a militarized zone, usually off limits to the American public. But elsewhere, in a desert gulch, Border Patrol agents examined the soles of his shoes to make sure they didn't waste time tracking his footprints in the sand.
You know, they're busy with other things, but I do have a right to be there, and I'm not doing anything. I'm just photographing.
Direct conflict remains unseen in this show. Without taking an explicit political stance, it addresses a highly charged issue by paying attention to small, intimate clues. Documenting the historical moment, Border Contos also suggests universal themes: the human journey, separation, the destruction of the environment, and the stories indicated by the telling objects we leave behind. For Cross Currents, I'm Julia Hutton in San Jose.
Border Cantos will be up at the San Jose Museum of Art through July. Find more information on our Facebook page. We're at KALW. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. And now we'll continue our series about the families of revolutionaries. Today, we're hearing about the life of Yuri Kochiyama. Kochiyama was the daughter of Japanese immigrants. She spent time in an internment camp in the 1940s, then moved to Harlem and became known as one of the fearless fighters for racial equality. Kochiyama fought for civil rights, Puerto Rican independence, and school integration. She was the founder of Asian Americans for Action, and she brought attention to the struggles of both Asians and African Americans. That's why I'm writing this to tell y'all, from a scholar, when I grow up, I wanna be just like today we meet another Kochiyama.
My name is Audie Kochiyama Holman, and I'm the daughter of Yuri Kochiyama.
Audie is a social justice activist here in the Bay Area. She spoke with KALW's Lila Day about growing up in a revolutionary household.
In the kitchen, there was a long table, and it was facing the wall that had leaflets about political cases, demonstrations, cultural events, political prisoners, maybe a few photos. And so you kind of felt like it was, you were surrounded by the movement.
Were there other Asian American families that lived in the neighborhood that you lived in?
Very few. She was really well accepted in the Harlem and Black movement. People started to get to know her and trust her, so that there was never a feeling like we were outsiders.
Right. Did you ever feel like your mom's work was sort of getting in the way of your connection to her as just being mom?
I think for the family, there was a bit of that, you know, is that she was always involved in something, like she had to go to meetings or she had to go to a demonstration or she had to write an article. And I think there were times that my brothers and my sister and I might have thought, oh, I wish we had a little more, quote, normal family or more traditional family. But basically, we had a loving family and we had lots of friends. And the other part of it is my mother, our house was just open to anyone. It was like people might drop off their kid for a night or 2 weeks, months, a year.
Wow.
Yes.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Leela Day, speaking with Audie Kochiyama-Holman. And so 1964.
Yeah, so she had invited Malcolm X to come to our house because there were three Japanese journalists who were victims of the atomic bombing. And they were asked, who would you like to meet if you came to the United States? And the one person they wanted to meet was Malcolm X. And so then the door knocks and there's Malcolm X with one of his close associates with him. And so my mother was just so thrilled, and everybody in the room. And he was just so warm and friendly and, you know, just so down to earth.
So one of the images that's seen a lot in the media is one of your mother, mm-hmm. Yuri Kochiyama, when she's sort of cradling Malcolm X when he was assassinated in Harlem in 1965. Do you remember that day?
Yeah, I do. I didn't go to the Audubon Ballroom that day. At some point when these, whoever was starting to shoot, my mother, when most people hit the ground, her first instinct was to run up on the stage to help, to see what happened. And she saw somebody running in front of her, maybe one of his associates, and she just ran behind. And at that point, he had just fallen back. And so she put his head on her lap, and he was just about taking his last breath. And then somebody from Life magazine took that photo, and then right after, then his wife came up on the stage, and his daughter, Atala Shabazz, spoke at my mother's memorial in New York, and she mentioned that she said, I'll never, she was a young child then, she said, but I'll never forget seeing Yuri running up there when grown men were running out the doors.
So here's your mom, Yuri Kochiyama, giving a speech. Let's have a listen.
Hopefully, Asians will side with the most dispossessed, oppressed, and marginalized, remembering our own history. We Asians need to reshape our image from the rather quiet, ambiguous, accommodating, uncomplaining, palatable people to a more resolute, sensitive advocate for human worth, human rights, and human dignity.
Your mother just passed away in June of 2014, and at the age of 93, was she still an activist until even up into her 90s? Was there things that she felt really strongly about?
There were, although the last few years she started to get dementia, so I think she didn't understand everything that was going on, especially the last, say, 2 years. Remember at one of the facilities where she was living, someone who was in a room across the hall would tell me, she said, you know, your mother's really interesting. Sometimes I hear her talking to the Black Panthers or like she's giving a speech.
So they would hear your mother giving speeches.
So there were moments where she would say, even in her dementia, would say to me, like, what's going on in the world? Is there still wars in the Middle East?
You must miss her quite a bit.
Yeah. I felt in many ways really privileged that I was around to help her in these last years when she was less independent.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Because I think, you know, we always saw her as this very strong woman who was taking care of things on her own and sometimes not wanting to help. And in these last few years, it just felt good to be able to give back to her and help her when she needed it most.
That was Audie Kochiyama-Holman speaking with KALW's Leela Day. Thanks to Shireen Adil for production help. The conversation is part of our series of interviews with the families of revolutionaries. Tomorrow we'll talk with Issa Angela Davis.
It was hard for me to give myself that permission to be different than my parents, you know, than my mom and my aunt.
That's tomorrow on Cross Currents. You can find today's conversation and all of our stories online at klw.org. Click Cross Currents. And we want to ask, if you could talk to the family of a famous person, who would it be? Tell us at 415-264-7106 and leave a message. That's 415-264-7106, or shoot us an email at news@kalw.org. We do read them all because we love hearing from you. Try us. Our team includes Lisa Bartfai, Audrey Dilling, Angela Johnston, Truk Nguyen, James Rollins, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Jeremy Dalmas. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by San Francisco alternative twang trio Rin Tin Tiger. They play tomorrow at the Milk Bar on Haight Street in San Francisco. Music starts at 8 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. When they cut down the tree, all I did was yell timber. I ain't got no splinter, and I don't need no splinter remedies. And no, not me. My voice box is a blue whale scarred, singing in a minor key. The soulless disc grab me their face and point to mere casual.